time for the Labor Hour. Big JWJ meeting. I suppose there might be some discussion of that. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily others here at the station. Kicking it off.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting throughout Central Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speaker and do not represent the views necessarily of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
Thanks, Dave. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call, 217-328-2295. Also, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interest of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Also, programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the Illinois World Labor Hour. And we're back to Dave.
Okay, got some news stories. First of all, Bob was absent a couple of our programs the last 2 weeks, and last weekend he was down in southern Arkansas for a blues festival. You want to just give a little highlight of that, Bob?
The King Biscuit Blues Festival in Helena, Arkansas. I've been going on down there for about 30 years. Goes back, the King Biscuit time was a long time radio program. Weekly blues program, first hosted by Sonny Boy Williamson back in the 40s and early 50s, and been broadcasting weekdays ever since. Very influential radio program, blues, all of the blues cats that grew up in the Delta down there, including Muddy Waters and B.B. King, all say that they listened to it. It was actually on the air at 12:15 because that was the time when all of the sharecroppers took their lunch breaks out there in the fields and stuff like that. King Biscuit Blues Festival, great opportunity to get down there to the Delta, see what an amazing little city Helena, Arkansas is.
How big is it?
And these days it's 12,000 people.
That's small.
And that's a combination of Helena, West Helena.
Okay.
In its heyday, Helena had about 35,000 people there. Had two main streets, Cherry Street, which is still kind of a main street, I guess you could call it, was the white main street, and one block over was Walnut Street, and that was the African-American main street. And it was a hub. I mean, there was all kinds of bowling alleys and lawyers and doctors' offices and car dealerships and things like that, and then industries in that area have since.
What industries were they?
Lumber industry, a lot to do with the river. It's right on the Mississippi River. Helena, I think, is still, or at one time was kind of the river pilot's place. Everybody that was training to be a pilot on the Mississippi River had to go down there and take schooling down there. Lumber industry, and of course the cotton industry, because in that area, cotton was king.
Yes.
Was king.
Yeah. Oh, what, biscuits were king, weren't they?
Yeah, they had the Sonny Boy cornmeal down there, and that was actually the company down there. King Biscuit Cornmeal Company, I think, something like that.
King Biscuit Flour Hour.
Yeah,
well,
I remember that.
Is that a different show?
They kind of co-opted that name, and they ended up copyrighting the name, and they stole it. So for a few years, they didn't steal it, I should say. The views and opinions expressed. They co-opted the name and copyrighted it. So for a few years, they had to call themselves the Arkansas Blues and Heritage Fest, but then some things happened, and some people bought it and gave it back to the festival.
Well,
so now, once again, it's the King Biscuit
Blues
Festival.
Right here, we have a little microcosm of America, its industrial history, how a town can basically almost die. I mean, it literally actually decimated from, 35,000 to 3,000.
Yeah.
And, from losing industries and so on, and the machinations of the King Biscuit people over the name of the show, there's something I wanted to bring up, Dave, a few minutes here, and it's last week I brought up the debt limit. Mm-hmm. Wasn't really sure about what it was, how and why it was. Basically, what it was is it's a convenience.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, there were parliamentary rules that, and since they were rules of those bodies, they could be changed by them anytime too.
Mm-hmm.
They either had rules where they didn't want to spend so much, or they had to vote individually on every bond. And what the debt limit does is just says, well, okay, you can sell all these bonds up to this point.
Okay.
At the very least. And also, but it is often thought redundant due to the 14th Amendment, which says that all the debts in America, you know, will be paid. And if a really good place to find out about it this week is in Rolling Stone magazine,
mm-hmm.
if you can get past the Walking Dead cover. And and it talks about the zombies in the Republican zombies in the House, and it's an article called A House Divided by Sean Willance, who is a George Henry Davis 1886 professor of American history at Princeton. And his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, which won a Bancroft. Okay. So, but anyway, so he gives a really good historical perspective also. He says here, the date ceiling dates back to America's entry into World War I. Contrary to widespread misimpression, it came into existence not as a constraint on congressional spending, but in order to make government fiscal procedures less cumbersome amid the pressures of mobilizing for war. Actually, what he's saying there is it makes more spending easier, mm-hmm. rather than being a constraint on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes through and talks a little bit more about the history of it. Rather, the ceiling... Congress does that as part of the normal legislative process, that is, approved spending. Nor does the ceiling have anything to do with annual deficit levels, which explains why even today, with the deficit shrinking, Congress still needs to raise a debt ceiling. Rather, the ceiling is an artificial cap determined by Congress on the amount that the government can borrow to cover obligations already made. But then he goes through, there's about a few more paragraphs where he explains it really well, especially the number of times it's been raised. Since 1960, Congress raised the ceiling 78 times. Just 7 times under George W. Bush, 7 times under Barack Obama. It just depends on how many terms you spend, sure. basically, in
yeah.
office.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be coming up within the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Inform your fellow workers when they start talking about the things that they miss here on whatever
in
media.
In the corporate media, yeah.
That is misreporting on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just can't help feel that this is all a technique of shock doctrine
Be very afraid.
Yeah.
The debt ceiling.
Before that, it was the fiscal cliff, right? We're all going to fall.
Oh, wait a minute. That was Walking Dead. Sorry.
Oh, okay. But no, it's just, and I can't help but feel that, in addition to the Republicans, that the corporate Democrats, including Obama, are playing a big charade here, a good cop, bad cop game to go after Social Security and Medicare. That's so funny because why is it that great post on Facebook, Bill, where you posted about why is it that a retired person's $1,000 a month Social Security check is going to bankrupt the country, yet a billionaire who's not paying his taxes doesn't?
Yes.
Great post.
Oh, wait till you see the ones with the little children, poor children going, Mommy, how come we have to give up food for the rich people? Don't they have enough money? Those are all over the place, too, over the food stamps. Well, and because Social Security is not part of the federal budget.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that's the thing that has to be remembered here.
And I suppose if they do cut back, then that means money that they've already borrowed from Social Security.
Yes.
Maybe they won't have to pay as much
exactly.
back.
Exactly. And not to mention the long-term goal of privatizing Social Security is what the real long-term goal here is, to give more money to their buddies on Wall Street, both the Republicans and Obama and the other corporate Democrats, in my opinion. So anyway, based on fact.
I will concur.
Yes. Okay, worldwide, fast food is a $240 billion a year industry. There is no excuse not to pay a $15 an hour wage. Check out the big profits for the big winners. Subway. Today there are more than 27,000 Subway restaurants in 85 countries. Wow, that's surprising.
Dave.
Yes.
They just opened a Subway restaurant in Bement.
Wow.
Which I cannot believe. And yeah. They had spent a lot of money on it. There was people work. It took like 6 months to build the thing.
Oh, wow.
Or convert the existing building.
Yeah, so they're in 85 countries employing more than 150,000 people with worldwide sales totaling more than $9 billion annually. McDonald's now boasts annual profits of more than $21 billion. In 1968, McDonald's operated about 1,000 restaurants worldwide, but today has more than 31,000. Pizza Hut is the world's largest pizza chain, operating more than 12,500 stores in 100 countries and employing 140,000 people. And
by the way, Pizza Hut, at least around here, never builds union.
Yes. And it goes on and on and on here. It goes on to say our own, here in Champaign, Central Illinois, our own Jimmy John Leotard.
Nah.
I always call him Leotard. Owner of Jimmy John Sandwich Shop is currently at 1,600 shops nationwide, opening 200 stores per year nowadays. His website promises franchisees $1.5 million of annual profits per year. Jimmy John's was one of the first fast food restaurants to have workers rebel and nearly start an IWW union in Minneapolis. Other trivia about Jimmy John's, Jimmy Leotard was the first defendant in Champaign County history to be tried under the new date rape law passed in Illinois.
Oh, yeah.
Represented by the best trial lawyer in the county at the time, one Stephen Beckett, 12 elderly white jurors took 6 hours to decide Jimmy was not guilty. At the time, he had only 13 stores. Fast forward 19 years later, and it was Leotard who Beckett called upon to donate $200,000 to finish the clock tower on the newly renovated Champaign County Courthouse. Leotard gave the 2010 commencement address at the U of I. Photographs were discovered of Leotard hunting large game animals in Africa of dubious legality, for which Smile Politely, a local periodical, a local, they exposed the photos, generating over 200 comments. Leotard caused further publicity recently by threatening to move his corporate headquarters out of Champaign, Illinois because of a 67% tax hike in the state income taxes. Yet that has not happened, as local leaders have wined, dined, and schmoozed and cajoled the Jimmy not to take his ball and go to Florida.
You know, I do have to say one. There is one thing, Dave. He did, I believe, is over $100,000 donation to. The name's escaping me now.
He gives money to everybody.
Yeah, the medical
care. Except his workers.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Because they probably have to use it. The medical care facility in town here for low-income people.
Francis Nelson,
yes. I just thought about that. Thank you, Bob, because his workers probably need to use it because he doesn't pay him enough. So he gives him a big $100,000 or whatever it was.
Yes, we have a personal friend of my wife's who worked for him as a quote-unquote manager, which means that she was basically getting paid $15 an hour to work 60 to 70 hours a week. She did get health insurance, but basically they sent her down, of course, pumped her full of all these lies about how she's going to rise, into the company and become a millionaire. Gullible, yes, but anyway, they sent her down to Florida to manage six stores. She was working an ungodly number of hours. Anyway, it drove her to an attempted suicide.
Well, Dave, you said all that where she was going to rise up and be a millionaire and all that. Now, if you're organizing a union, you cannot go in there and guarantee people, or even imply any type of certainty that they're going to get a raise or
yes.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
That would not be legal.
Mm-hmm.
But they can go in and hire some naive person and pump them up full, like you just said, and destroy their life.
Yeah.
He's got enough money to sponsor some NASCAR cars, so he's doing something right.
Wow. Yeah, that's a pretty big expense.
Do you ever drive by his corporate headquarters over there on Fox Drive?
Yes.
He's got that little sign out there that says 800 people hired in the last month or something like that.
I never saw the sign.
Yeah, so many thousand jobs created in the last year or something like that, So.
Something weird, too. I don't know about his house, but I do. I was working with people who worked on it.
Yeah.
I think Bro and Russo built it.
Yes.
Which is really, it must be a hell of a house then.
Yeah. It's a tacky looking house. It doesn't fit the neighborhood over there by the Champaign Country Club because those are more older houses were built back in the 20s and 30s. You know, who says rich people have good taste? It doesn't necessarily mean, you know. But, he is a despicable character. You know, the fact that he exploits his workers so bad. Not to mention the fact that my wife works at a local grade school. And for the longest time, they refused to deliver there in the daytime because they said it was a dangerous neighborhood.
Well, here's one, too. When I see people with their food on jobs, I say something about it.
Yeah.
And that's one thing. I mean, I don't get into a lot of stuff, but I'll bring up that tax deal. I said, man, he's, you know, threatening to leave because he doesn't want to pay the same tax as you do.
Yeah. Bob?
I got a story here, actually kind of a good one. This is from our friend and great labor reporter Mike Elk in these times.
Oh, yes, you know? Out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Last week, the United Mine Workers of America announced a settlement in its long fight with Peabody Energy that will preserve health care benefits for thousands of retired miners. Peabody has agreed to provide more than $400 million to start a health care fund for the 20,000 retired miners and beneficiaries whose retirement plans had been threatened by the bankruptcy of Patriot Coal, a Peabody spinoff. It says, I'm very pleased that we have been able to reach this agreement with Peabody and Patriot, said United Mine Workers International President Cecil E. Roberts in an official statement. This is a significant amount of money that will help maintain health care for thousands of retirees who earned those benefits through years of labor in America's coal mines. The settlement will also help Patriot emerge from bankruptcy and continue to provide jobs for our members and thousands of others in Western Virginia and Kentucky. The United Mine Workers has contended for years that Peabody Energy created Patriot Coal to fail as a vehicle to offload the parent company's retiree obligations. When Peabody Energy founded Patriot Coal in 2007, Patriot assumed financial responsibility for 40% of Peabody's retiree health care and pensions. The next year, Patriot acquired a company called Magnum Coal, itself a spinoff from mining giant Arch Coal. Magnum brought with it $500 million in Arch's retiree obligations. Patriot ended up with a retiree-to-worker ratio of more than 3-1. That's three retirees for every one person working.
Well, that's three companies worth of retirees.
Yeah. When Patriot went bankrupt in the summer of 2012, the company successfully pressed a bankruptcy judge to eliminate retiree obligations, leaving thousands of former workers without viable safety nets. After months of negotiations ensued between Peabody, Patriot, United Mine Workers Union, and an outside investment firm, Knighthead Management, a deal on retiree pensions was struck earlier this year, but health care remained up in the air until last Wednesday when the parties announced a multi-part deal. So some good news for some hard-working coal miners out of the American mines there. Hopefully they'll get the health care benefits that they are entitled to after many years of working.
Well, that hearing stories like that make me feel better that I have what's called a Taft-Hartley pension plan that's provided for. One of the good parts of the Taft-Hartley Act and my pension and whatever pension. Dave, do you have some pension out of the carpenters?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, no one contractor can take that pension, can they? Nobody owns it. You know, it's not up for grabs if somebody's going out of business.
Right.
I don't understand why we don't have laws in the United States to prevent this.
Well, I don't know. And then a bankruptcy judge allows it to happen. So, you just kind of wonder how these laws are written so that this can just happen.
Yeah, I mean, I get
the stamp of approval.
Yes, I would think that it would be that, the pension. The retirees have first claim over anybody. That's why. Well,
one would think so, but somehow in this our financial system, the bondholders always seem to be the first people that get paid off.
That's like we can't have this happen because they'll freak out the bondholders.
Yes. Well, Bill, you mentioned about the Taft-Hartley plans that the
construction. I think I'm going to buy. If I buy some bonds, can I have power like that?
You got it, Bill.
You mentioned the Taft-Hartley health plans that the construction trades have. Well, those are under threat because of Obamacare, which leads into this next article from Counterpunch, from a working class man in West Virginia. The title of it is Grand Theft Health Insurance. Unlike the sort of like the video game Grand Theft Auto.
Who's this guy, this working
Russell,
man?
Mulkeeper. He says, here I sit in West Virginia.
Oh, yeah, I've read a lot by him.
Okay, here I sit in West Virginia staring down at January 1st, 2014. That's when my health insurance policy expires, and I have a decision to make, renew or not renew. Right now I'm paying about $7,000 a year in premiums for a monster deductible, nearly out of pocket of about $15,000 for myself and my family.
Man.
He said, my health insurance company informed me yesterday that my premium will be doubled to $14,000 a year on January 1st. He goes, I've been trying to get onto the Obamacare website now for 10 days to search for an alternative. No luck. I made it through four pages yesterday, then got a message saying I have to wait because there was too much traffic. When I clicked the continue button, it wiped out the information I had typed into the first three pages. But even if I do get on these changes, it's probably not going to matter. I read in the newspaper that Highmark is the only health insurance company on exchange in West Virginia. Yesterday I called Highmark and spent an hour on the phone with a nice young man, but the results were not good. The skimpiest plan is going to cost me more than I'm paying now for a higher deductible and out-of-pocket results. Thank you, Obamacare. My insurance agent told me yesterday I had only one alternative. Wait for 6 years until Medicare kicks in for me, or keep fighting for single payer. He goes on to say, obviously the Democrats and anyone who defends them are not going to be any help in this next round. They are irrevocably tied to President Obama and Obamacare. And even those Democrats nominally in favor of single-payer refuse to criticize it for the industry-written law that it is. I agree with Dr. Quentin Young of Physicians for a National Health Program when he says that Obamacare should have been defeated because it enshrines and solidifies corporate domination of the health care system. But what do we do next?
Oh, yeah, by the way, Quentin Young was known as Obama's doctor, wasn't he, in Chicago?
Yes.
And he's a longtime healthcare advocate.
Indeed.
Matter of fact, he was probably one of the second people that Peter Miller interviewed.
Really?
Yes, he was live in the studio many, many years ago.
Great, okay. But what to do next? Well, the first thing is to watch a movie called Healthcare, the movie. And it's a short documentary comparing, interviewing people in Canada and the U.S. about their healthcare systems. It's narrated by Tommy Douglas. And a lot of the film is about Keith Sutherland, who is Tommy Douglas' grandson.
Yeah.
And Tommy Douglas was the premier.
Their healthcare is so good, they brought Tommy Douglas back to life.
Yes, premier. But anyway, Tommy Douglas was a preacher and a boxer for a while, and he's a premier of Saskatchewan who stood up to the red baiting being dished out at the time by the Canadian medical establishment, and Douglas emerged victorious, and his effort resulted in Canada's healthcare system, Medicare for All. And what's interesting, Tommy Douglas was just recently voted in a poll by Canadians as one of the most beloved, famous Canadians. But what's really interesting, just to summarize the movie does a good job of making us Americans feel like crap compared to our cousins up north. Check out this sequence, for example. How many people in the United States die each year because they have no health insurance? 45,000. How many people in Canada die each year because they have no health insurance? Zero. How many people go bankrupt each year in the United States because of medical expenses? 922,819. How many people go bankrupt each year in Canada because of medical expenses? Zero. How many Americans do not have any health insurance? Not to talk about the crappy health insurance, but how many have absolutely none? 50 million. How many Canadians don't have health insurance? Zero. How many Americans go without medical care because of cost? 115 million.
Wow.
And how many Canadians go without medical care because of cost? Zero. So I just wanted to read that. I thought it was great. And he just basically summarizes here at the end real quick. He says that there is no reason that we can't get Medicare for All in the United States. It's simply a matter of reordering our priorities. Let's put aside for a moment our millions of copies of Grand Theft Auto 5 and start playing a new game, Grand Theft Health Insurance. The goal of the game is to become a boxer like Tommy Douglas and fight back against the insurance industry and its Frankenstein monster, Obamacare.
Dave, I want to make a point here.
Yeah. Yes.
Everybody's always really into innovation and people being able to go out and sustain themselves and maybe create a new business and create some jobs, you know.
Uh-huh.
But meanwhile, you probably have millions of people sitting around going, well, I got health insurance with this job, so I don't know if I want to.
Yes.
Hey.
Yes, that, hey, that's that our caller, by the way, Steve Early. So we'll get him on the line here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hello, it's Steve Early for Dave Johnson.
Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Well, folks, we have Steve Early on the phone, who just recently was out back in September, attended the National AFL-CIO Convention in Los Angeles, and he wrote a great article I was really impressed with called Labor in La La Land. And I wanted him to call and kind of share that with us. But first, Steve, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I spent close to 30 years working for the Communication Workers Union in New England as a national union rep, working with CWA locals on contract campaigns and negotiations and strikes and organizing and local leadership training programs. Currently living in the Bay Area of California and working as a freelance labor journalist, and have written a couple of labor-related books, including a new one that's coming out by the end of the year from Monthly Review Press called Save Our Unions, a Timely Plea, if there ever was one.
Okay. Well, what inspired you to title your piece Labor in La La Land?
Well, I guess I was being a little bit snarky.
Okay. we get snarky ourselves occasionally.
A well-known way of referring to Los Angeles, a city based on the make-believe, on Hollywood tall tales that may not fully reflect the reality of our day-to-day lives. You know, the AFL-CIO convention is held every 4 years. It's a not entirely representative gathering. It's about 1,500 people, many of them full-time officials, from state and local AFL-CIO bodies and from national unions. This particular convention was probably better than any they've ever had in a number of areas. One, it was very inclusive. A lot of non-delegates were invited from the Workers' Center movement, from allied progressive organizations, from environmental groups, student organizations, a lot of different labor support groups. And as a result, the crowd of guests, of those not actually empowered to vote but just hang out for a few days, was a lot more diverse, a lot younger, a lot livelier than the usual AFL-CIO convention crowd. So all of that was very positive. But, you know, some of the most serious challenges facing the labor movement, in my humble opinion, were really not tackled very effectively at the meeting.
Okay, you know, that's one thing that, I tell you what, it was a great article. One thing that, you know, really struck me was that, you know, you gave a lot of praise to this inclusiveness, including all the campaigns going on with different, non-union, but basically non-profit organizations that are forming kind of like workers' alliances around, you know, the fast food industry and everything else, and you thought that was a great thing, which, you know, we can't disagree with. But one thing you mentioned was it seemed like, despite that the union leadership was basically kind of using this to distract away from a lot of the current problems that current union members are facing throughout the country and have been for quite a few years.
Absolutely. I mean, we have, you know, up to 20 million workers, retirees, and their families who are covered, as you know, by multi-employer health and pension plans that are under serious threat these days. And these cover people working in manufacturing and transportation and construction, some of the retail trades. You know, the effect of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, on these multi-employer health plans has been very damaging so far. And Congress is about to take up some changes in the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, the pension reform law that has long protected retirees from pension cuts in a way that might lead to more retired union members losing parts of their pension check. So, I mean, these are serious challenges affecting millions of existing members, the hard core of organized labor, if you will. And very little time at the convention was allocated, except at the very end, when there was a quite angry debate about what to do about the negative impact of the Affordable Care Act on union members.
Yes, we talk a lot about that on the show, and you know, we get into a lot of, especially me, into a lot of heated debates and almost arguments with some of our quote-unquote progressive friends who seem to think that Obamacare is the best thing since sliced bread and all that. I don't want to go into that so much, even though I think it's great that you mentioned that that was one of the big issues. And you also mentioned on the same topic about a lot of the challenges that members are facing on the job as far as problems organizing new members because of the laws, also where you thought that the union should be maybe spending some more time, you know, with more steward training, more, you know, rank-and-file activists and that kind of thing. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if the labor movement is clearly under siege. Its ranks are shrinking. Unions are on the defensive. But, you know, we still have a base of 15 to 16 million members. And if you don't shore up that base, I don't think you're going to be a very effective ally for other progressive organizations. I don't think you're going to be able to give the kind of support to new forms of worker organizing that we certainly want to encourage, whether it's in fast food or Walmart or anywhere else, because, you know, the problems of existing union members, those who are paying dues today, those who are still engaged in collective bargaining where they can in the private and public sector, they have day-to-day problems that they expect their organizations to help them deal with, and you can't walk away from that membership base. I think that would be very, very, very self-defeating. So I think, you know, those of us who spent many years as elected local officers or appointed staff people who have been involved in enforcing contracts and training stewards and trying to strengthen workplace networks believe that those tasks can't be neglected. The basic day-to-day union functions have to be shored up and supported more strongly. At the same time, the labor movement is trying to do some new and better things in the area of political action and organizing the unorganized.
Well, very well said, Steve. So what's the title of your book that you're coming out with?
It's called Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, and it has some sections that deal with the controversies you just mentioned about mm-hmm. the Affordable Care Act versus a Medicare for All solution to our health care problems. It also deals with the state of the strike, some innovative campaigns to organize the unorganized, some experiments in independent political action, and mm-hmm. Really a range of topics that I think listeners of the show might find of interest.
Okay. Well, I don't know. You're probably aware of this, but I guess Labor Notes Conference is going to be this year in Chicago, the first week of April. Were you planning on attending? Or?
I have missed only one because of a difficult bargaining and strike situation in the last 3 decades that mm-hmm. we've been having the conferences. I'm on the Labor Notes Policy Committee, and 2 years ago in Chicago, as a result of participation by local teachers and transit workers, we had 1,500 people at this conference. It's really a wonderful, inspiring, uplifting event. And as you said, it is the first weekend in April of 2014. I would urge people to check out the Labor Notes website, where there's already information about the conference, particularly for folks in the Midwest. Don't have to travel that far to get there. I think they'll find it a wonderful 2 or 3 days of workshops and discussions and cross union networking that'll really leave you feeling pumped up and a lot more optimistic about what we can do to revive the labor movement.
You know, I've never been able to attend a Labor Notes conference, unfortunately. I've tried several times, but it never worked out. But this year, I'm definitely going. I checked out the website.
We should propose a workshop about labor radio, because there's a great network of people doing work like you've been doing with World Labor Hour, and we need to support these efforts in alternative labor media.
Well, I'll take you up on that. Let's just expand it to labor media in general, because you know, I also have a public access television program here, a labor television program, and I think there's a lot of these public access television stations around the country are there, and they're kind of underutilized, and I think it'd be a great opportunity to get labor's, especially, you know, rank and file perspectives out there. So I'm going to take you up on that. I'm going to try to get a contingent from Champaign to come up, Champaign-Urbana, Central Illinois even.
Fantastic.
So anyway,
you know, Dave, okay, this is Bill Grell.
Yes, and Bill's a union labor, by the way, and I'm a retired union carpenter, just to let know. And I go ahead, Bill.
Well, anyway, I was just thinking about this. Dave did mention his local show, and there are two channels, basically, at least on the satellite networks, and I think on a lot of cable systems, called Free Speech TV and Link TV. And while they will occasionally run labor-related one-shot programs, neither of those channels has a regular weekly labor program, although they do have weekly programs on other issues. That might be somewhere something people at Labor Knows could talk about, because I don't think I'll make it, but we'll see.
Very definitely. There are Labor Knows people around the country who have been local correspondents for Workers Independent News based in Madison. You know them well. We don't, which is, as over the last few years, tried to boost labor content in a lot of radio outlets around the country.
I wonder if Steve Zeltzer's thought about this. Zeltzer. Yeah. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, you know Steve Zeltzer, don't you? He lives out here.
I do.
Okay.
Yes, as a new resident of the Bay Area, Steve is a fellow member of mine now in the freelancer section of the Bay Area Newspaper Guild.
Okay. By the way, we have a local friend of ours who currently is a staffer for SEIU here in Champaign-Urbana. He used to be in the a staffer in the communication workers in Buffalo, New York, and he said he knew you, Ricky Baldwin. He wanted me to say hello to you. And but anyway, I want to get to another little contentious little incident, I guess you would, around the National AFL-CIO Convention. That was the pull out of the ILWU, the West Coast Longshoremen.
Yes, well, that's really a pretty troubling situation. The West Coast Longshore Union, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, has a long and storied tradition of militancy, spanning the last 60 or 70 years, and certainly has demonstrated its commitment to solidarity and support activity and even strike activity over issues affecting other groups and not the union's own members directly. They have been hampered in recent years in several ports on the West Coast by sweetheart deals negotiated by other AFL-CIO unions,
like the operating engineers,
undercut their contract standards, and they had made some efforts to try to get this issue addressed through state AFL-CIO bodies in Washington State and Oregon, and then also tried to raise it nationally. But you know, they're a small union; they only have about 60,000 members, very strategic members. They don't have a lot of clout within the AFL, and when they felt their concerns were not being addressed right before the convention, a month or so ago, they pulled out of the National AFL-CIO.
Now, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong here, but this problem, this was that you mentioned sweetheart deals, and what it was that a lot of the employers, dock employers, were basically ILWU had disputes with them, and while this ongoing dispute was occurring, the employers cut a deal with the operating engineers to cross the ILWU's picket lines, and the National AFL-CIO refused to mediate this dispute. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm. And then there have also been some tensions with the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Mm. And I think, you know, this is not helpful at a time when all unions are under attack, for some to position themselves as friends of the employers, leaving other unions in the lurch. And it's really going to take a lot of bonding at the rank-and-file level to change that kind of misbegotten leadership strategy in a couple of the building trades unions involved. As far as the Longshore Union, I mean, they're going to need a plan B. I mean, if you're not part of the AFL-CIO, okay. I mean, there's a bunch of unions that are outside the AFL-CIO, but what is your community labor coalition building strategy? And I think they're going to need to strengthen networks like Jobs with Justice in Seattle and Portland and here in the Bay Area of California, so that they do have ties with other unions and community organizations that they're going to continue to need, because nobody can fight these battles all by themselves, even if, you know, in the past their militance and strategic position has enabled them to win most of the time.
Yeah, well, Steve, you know, I find this ironic, or you might say hypocritical, in that the operators and the electricians, at least around here on the jobs I'm on, they are about the most protective of their work of all the trades.
Yeah, and it muddies the waters when you have a big public dispute and people are taking risks to fight for a decent contract, and then you know, the management people you're dealing with say, well, you know, we're not trying to go non-union. We're just trying to find a kind of a more reasonable union to deal with. And here we're going to do this work that's disputed under a union contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really makes the public relations aspect of the dispute more difficult for the union that's trying to uphold contract standards. But I think, you know, in my own experience over the years in the telephone industry in the Northeast, we used to have very big problems, divisions between CWA-represented telephone workers and our brothers and sisters in the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And over time, over a 20-year period, we built a very strong united front in bargaining and strikes and membership mobilization. And you have to do that at the rank-and-file level. People in union headquarters in Washington are never going to resolve these things favorably.
You know, that's a good point, Steve, because, you know, Bill, being out of the laborers' union, and myself, a former member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, retired, we've seen over the years how the national leadership and even, you know, more the regional leadership, a lot of times will do very despicable things that are just the opposite of what union solidarity should be. And the members don't agree with it. I mean, the majority of the members don't agree with it. In fact, in the Carpenters, we had an ongoing internal rebellion of the rank and file, which unfortunately was crushed because of our horrible labor laws and payoffs to certain judges and politicians. But yet, you know, this, you know, I guess this leads into the other topic that you've touched on before, is about, you know, union democracy.
Yeah, correct. I mean, if you're a member of a union and you and your coworkers are upset with the direction of the union, the unresponsiveness of the leadership, the way they're handling contract negotiations or contract enforcement, you ideally want to have the ability to shake things up, to elect new people, to develop a more effective union program, and where there are not free and fair internal union elections, where people don't have a chance to run for office, you really end up having some pretty out of touch and unresponsive union officialdoms. And we've seen progress over the years in the Teamsters and the transit workers in New York, and most recently in the postal workers, where workers do have the right to vote directly for their top leadership, they're able to use that tool to bring about some important changes.
Yeah, but unfortunately in other unions, especially the carpenters unions, you don't have that opportunity. It's any time that locals have voted out you know, unresponsive executive boards or other delegates, the international union comes in and puts them in trusteeship, and in violation of the law, I might add, but yet the courts always uphold the international's trusteeships. And, you know, you of course, were friends with a friend of mine who just passed away recently on Easter Sunday morning, Harry Kelber, who was a big critic. I mean, this man goes all the way back to his own organizing in the 1930s in New York City. Worked inside the labor movement as a, you know, an instructor for many years for the Electricians Union in New York City and the National AFL-CIO. And this man knows what the labor movement is all about, was part of it back in the day. And, you know, in his later years, he was just disgusted with how the way organized, you know, union, well, basically organized labor was going.
Yeah, and Harry was a great inspiration to many younger people starting to get active in the labor movement, starting to write about it. And, you know, but I think that there are some models. Certainly, it's more difficult in unions where trusteeship powers have been abused, where conventions are really a stacked deck and people don't have the one member, one vote mechanism for electing their top officers. But you know, in your own state, you've had the recent inspiring example of teachers in Chicago.
Yes.
Over a number of years, forming a reform caucus, working to change the leadership of their local. And then when they took over the Chicago Teachers Union, using the resources of the union to expand their steward network and develop a more effective approach to bargaining and building ties with the community and conducting an effective strike last year, taking on the mayor. It's a lot of work. It takes many years in some cases. But union democracy and reform struggles, I would agree, are still an essential part of the strategy for changing the labor movement in America.
Well, many unions, including my union, are a really good example of how elections do not equal democracy. For example, I believe this is the last time I heard on the local level anyway here, if we have an election and one of the candidates doesn't want to speak, then neither one of them can speak. Our last election had one seat contested, and that was for vice president, our only African-American officer, who and so on and so forth. Our officials always retire during their terms so that they can, the e-board can appoint somebody to have an incumbent advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I know this might sound like airing dirty laundry, but, you know, the way I look at it, Steve, and I don't know if you agree or disagree, is that, you know, we can't, I mean, we're in such a horrible situation currently in the United States.
Well, our membership is really not... And that's partly because of the union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't try and educate people on anything because they don't want it.
Yes.
And we don't have stewards on hardly any jobs or for hardly any contractors.
Used to be the case.
No, and it's just – and part of that is because there's no real advantage to being a steward. You still have to work just as much as anybody else. You don't get to walk around and observe people and things like that, like – and apparently stewards might in other situations.
Well, also, you know, at least in the carpenters, there's no longer stewards in the job because the employer wanted to get rid of them, the union officials would go along with it.
Well, so yeah, that's
you
right.
You undermine the whole steward system. Yeah. But, yes, anyway, Steve, we're kind of running out. That's okay, Bill. That's a good point you brought
you
up.
You only have like a protection of not being fired specifically for union issues. Mm-hmm. You can be fired for not being good enough worker, and boy, that's a whole big can of worms
indeed.
Go through.
But Steve, I'm sorry, we're kind of yes,
inside ball.
Yes, but
rank and file.
Yes, if you want to respond.
Familiar problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
all too familiar, I'm sure. Sorry.
Listen, Steve, we're kind of running out of time, so I wanted you while we got this a few minutes or a minute here left anyway. Can you give us like a website and some other information?
Yes, it's readers want to go. It's the website of Monthly Review Press. If you Google Monthly Review Press, you can find how to pre-order a copy of Save Our Unions, and I would urge people to do that. You know, there's a lot of good material including case studies of a couple of successful local union reform struggles in the transit union and in the telephone industry, my own alma mater, CWA.
Oh, I want to say I recommend the Monthly Review. I haven't read it for a while, but it's a pretty good publication.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for calling in today, and I just want to say I don't want to end on a pessimistic note. I think there's I have a lot of long-term hope, even though we're kind of in a little bit of a mess here currently at present time with the state of workers in general in this country and organized labor, you know, as well. But I'm so glad that you have hope as well, and that not only you have hope, but you've got some very concise and pragmatic techniques and steps that where we can change the situation.
Well, thanks for having me on the show again. Great to talk with you both.
Indeed, and we'll be talking soon.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Ferrers, Bailey, Ferrell, Hebrides, Mallet, Rockall, Shannon, Seoul, Trafalgar, Finisterre, Irish Sea, Biscay, Humber, Portland, Cromarty, or Tyne.
Pontius Pilate came to our town, up to the dockyards to see the picket line. We asked him to help, but he just turned around. He's the leader of the Union now. Leader of
Okay, that was Chumbawamba with Good Ship Lifestyle and One by One, which was inspired by the docker strike in London, actually in England, I think it was Liverpool, and sort of the union leadership kind of, well, selling it out, if you will. But anyway, we're just about, you know, wrapping up here for the World Labor Hour, and we still have some underwriting announcements and some public service announcements.
Yeah, programming on the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. And also, the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And, interesting that they support other unions after the conversation you had with Steve Early and the fact that some of the unions were undercutting their fellow workers.
Yes, indeed. And I'll tell you what, the Graduate Employees Union here locally, the GEO, I mean, they are a model for what the labor movement in this country should be.
Yes. Oh, Dave, and I do want to say when it comes to the American labor movement in general, it is not a monolith.
Yes.
And, for example, the Bloomington Laborers Local is pretty much entirely different culture than my local here and possibly the one in Decatur and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of very good locals in all unions and a lot of good other bodies such as district councils and so on.
Indeed. But as we talked about before, unfortunately, I'd say probably unfortunately, most of the unions in the United States at this point in time, unfortunately, have the excuse me, corporate business model of unionism as opposed to solidarity, membership unionism.
You know, it's much like your government. On the local level, these people can be pretty good, but the farther you get up, the farther away they are from their public or their membership.
Yes.
Their constituents or their membership, and more isolated, the more they're around the people that they're supposed to be opposing.
But yet they go to cocktail parties with them and a lot of times accept jobs.
Inside the Beltway kind of thing.
Including the past president of the Chicago Federation of Labor, Dennis, I can't remember his last name, undermined a Walmart campaign there and then resigned his position and went to work for a big insurance company, you know, for a huge six-figure, you know, it's just really bad. But that's a good analogy, Bill. Quick public service announcement here. Sonny's Rib Supreme, bringing back, remember the good old days, we still care, ready to have a good time, then come to the 25 and over party at the American Legion Post 559, which is at 704 North Hickory Street behind the Neal Street Post Office. And that's next Saturday, October 26th, from 3 p.m. to 2 a.m. The party is to raise canned goods and food to help families that are in need during the Thanksgiving holidays. Your help will be greatly appreciated to help those that are in need. DJ Sir Charles will be there, and the kitchen will be open with the best food in town. So I want to thank Russell Barnes, who's been on the Labor Hour before, as a former co-worker and executive board member, colleague of mine, when we worked together in Champaign Public Schools and the support staff union of the IEA Teachers Support Staff Union.
Hey, I wanted to mention, you were talking about Tommy Douglas earlier, and you turned us on a few years ago, a year ago, to that little YouTube video that
Mouseland.
Mouseland.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's interesting about how the Mouse continued to vote for different cats, and they would vote for white cats, and then they didn't like them, they'd vote for black cats, and they would just simply change the size of the mouse hole so it was easier for the cats to catch the mice. Then they started voting for cats with polka dots on them and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting little video.
And then the one mouse stands up and say, why do mice keep voting for cats? Why don't we elect mice? And Tommy Douglas, in his usual Canadian voice, says, they called him a Bolshevik and threw him in jail.
What's the matter with Mouseland?
What's the matter with Mouseland?
Yeah, what's the matter with Kansas?
Oh, what's the matter with Kansas?
I see. Maybe Mouseland explains it more. Because what the parties do, they're whipsawing us. You know, they'll bring up the